Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Ryan Quarles is here. He's into his second term as the Commissioner of Agriculture for the state of Kentucky, and he has graciously accepted our invitation to talk about a laundry list of ag items. We thank you for stopping by Eastern Standard, Commissioner.
Glad to be here today. You know, one thing I love about my job is that we get to talk about food, and it's one of the few things that brings people together. I'm just honored to have a second term.
All right. Well, I'm told by your staff that a major focus for you right now is global trade, the global market.
Absolutely. If you are involved in Kentucky agriculture, we are already dependent on international trade. It's not a question of if or how we insert ourselves in the global market. We have to remind ourselves that 95% of the world's consumers live outside of the United States. And so we're going to be very focused on this. Number one, we have an amazing reputation. If you go around the world, you say you're from Kentucky, what do they ask you about? Bourbon, racehorses, and Kentucky Fried Chicken. And so with half of our soybeans, a fourth of our corn, and most of our tobacco ended up overseas, we are going to be very focused this term about connecting Kentucky farmers with international markets. And the timing couldn't be better with the trade uncertainty with China, with opportunities in Japan right now, as well as the newly signed USMCA, which renews our trading partnerships with Canada and Mexico.
Let's talk about that tension with China. Kentucky producers' projected net cash income is up slightly from 2018, but the UK economists who provided those figures say that that's largely due to the direct government payments that farmers have received from the Trump administration to try to help them survive this ongoing trade war. Has that support been adequate?
When we talk about trade disruption, we can talk about it in many different ways. The biggest offender here are retaliatory trade tariffs that were put on American agriculture goods going into China. These trade payments, called MFPs, proposed by the USDA and the Trump administration, were set to help offset that specific trade disruption with China. Now, your question is, are they adequate? If you were to go out and ask a Kentucky farmer, hey, would you rather have trade or aid? They're going to choose trade any day of the week. And so that's one reason why we're very hopeful that with the phase one signing with the Chinese leads to a further discussion so that there wouldn't be a need of government support to offset these issues. But there has been an adverse impact from decreased trade. The MFP payments have been helpful with offsetting the lost price that farmers usually enjoy. But it's still tough times out there with Kentucky agriculture.
Well, the ink was barely dry on that agreement when we learned about the coronavirus. And, of course, that's become increasingly disruptive day by day by day. How is that impacting things?
That's just yet another example where after years of work, a lot of man hours putting together a trade protocol and agreement can be disrupted overnight by unpredicted market forces, such as the coronavirus. And so agriculture, like other industries, we're shipping products, a lot of times raw products, overseas. We're flying our horses to China. And whenever you have a contagious disease like this, oftentimes that causes an acute and immediate disruption in trade. And this isn't the only virus and healthcare issue that we're dealing with the Chinese on right now. We're hopeful that the coronavirus can be contained. Whenever there's a situation like this, I'm so disheartened sometimes about how quickly it can spread around the world. And so I hope the Chinese and the American governments can work together to nip this in the bud.
So not the only disease. What are some of the other ones?
Well, one disease that a lot of consumers aren't aware of, it actually affects the Chinese hog population. It's called African swine fever. And in fact, China is the biggest producer of pork in the world. Unfortunately, this African swine fever has wiped out about half of their swine population.
Wow.
So when we have diseases in our animal livestock herds here in the United States, oftentimes it never makes the paper because we're able to contain it. We have strong biosecurity protocols here that not only researches where disease comes from but prevents it from spreading. Unfortunately, the Chinese do not have a strong enough biosecurity infrastructure, and so this disease continues to spread. It has decimated their hog population. But it does give American farmers an opportunity to export more into a country that is increasingly putting meat in their diet and displacing other traditional diets. And so we hope this might be an unfortunate situation for China with the disease issue, but we want to make sure it doesn't spread to the United States either.
Well, with trade issues, disease, and of course weather, uncertainties are all a big part of farming anyway. But what are some practical ways that this trade uncertainty has shown itself on Kentucky farms?
Well, the best way to figure out what's going on a farm is go out, put your boots on, put the tailgate down on a farm truck and just talk to a farmer. They're the ones that can tell you oftentimes with greater precision than economists what the farm level impact of trade would be. And for a lot of our farmers, we're fortunate in Kentucky. They're very diverse. They have a lot of variety here. Unlike some of our flat states that surround us, states that start with I, our ag economy isn't just three or four crops. Here, it's apples to zucchinis and everything in between. A lot of us were former or current tobacco farmers, like myself, who grew up on a tobacco farm. The farmers are able to adapt easier in Kentucky to new crops. And that's one reason why hemp has been such a bright spot lately. They've been able to adapt it. But the farmers today will tell you, we want trade, we want it resumed, and we want new markets. And that's something that my administration will be focused on in countries such as Japan, the Philippines, and yes, even the United Kingdom, which just left the EU, which means we have to renegotiate yet another trade agreement with a country that's already buying a bunch of Kentucky agricultural goods.
And you just mentioned hemp. What is hemp's future as a viable Kentucky cash crop?
Hemp is a crop that connects Kentucky's past with its future. Henry Clay, hemp farmer. My family used to grow it during World War II because the U.S. Navy needed rope. And now that we have brought it back after 70 years of sleeping, we're starting to just now see in year number 7 the economic effects. We have 1,000 farmers growing it, 200 startup companies, hemp companies, that are trying to navigate a new product, inserting new technology. Some will get it. Some of them will enter and exit the market. But we expect over $100 million of Kentucky-grown hemp and hemp-derived products such as CBD to be sold out of the Commonwealth legally to Americans. But there is disruption in the market.
Some hemp processors in Kentucky have gone bankrupt recently. Will they be suspended from the Kentucky Hemp Licensing Program, or are they going to be held accountable in some way?
Well, a lot of them are being accountable through the court system already. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that we try to do is help work with our processors to try to figure out if there's any government obstacles that are preventing them from doing business. And right now, the biggest obstacle in hemp is the United States Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. We're simply asking them to say, please let us know how you're going to regulate CBD and other products. This is one of the few times where the hemp industry, is actually asking for guidance on how they're going to be regulated. And I'll just give you one quick example. Mm-hmm. Take fish oils, for example. There are prescription strength derivatives of fish oils. There are healthcare supplements you can go to a GNC or Walgreens and buy that are nutraceutical healthcare supplements. And there's also cooking ingredients. We think the same sort of tiered regulation would probably work for CBD. But the problem is the FDA, again, after years of knowing these products are out in the market, have yet to act. And that's what's causing some cash flow issues with our hemp companies. But we always advocate for them to stay current on paying their bills and pay Kentucky farmers first.
It does seem as though the market really has a way to go to sort itself out.
That's right.
Right now, most of the hemp crop in Kentucky, as I understand it, like 90% is going to CBD.
That's right. Cannabinoids.
And as we speak on this day, of course, this interview will air a little bit later, but the House Agriculture Committee in Frankfort, I think you were there.
That's right.
Has passed a resolution encouraging Congress to raise the THC limit in hemp products to 1%. Why is that important?
As we bring this crop back, we're dealing with unstable genetics. The hemp crop that my great-grandfather grew was primarily for fiber and seed. But today's hemp crop is being dominated by CBD and other cannabinoids. And oftentimes, the compounds that hemp farmers are growing it for and processors are extracting kind of push the THC limits, which is 0.3% of THC. And a lot of us think that because that window is so narrow, 0.3%, that it's causing genetics that otherwise would be viable to not pass the THC test. And unfortunately, when a hemp crop comes in over that level, a lot of times it has to be disposed of. And so raising it to 1% gives our farmers and researchers a little more wiggle room. We'll still enforce it at 1%, but it would allow us to stabilize the genetics and, who knows, perhaps create some new products that might benefit society.
You know, we were talking about regulation a second ago, too, and one thing that's been called to my attention is that the 0.3% applies to the hemp, not necessarily what's in the bottle, correct? Because sometimes that THC level can be much higher.
Well, it shouldn't be. Every hemp product, whether it comes off the farm or at the retail, should be compliant with 0.3% or less. In fact, there's a lot of hemp products that have zero THC in it. It's been completely distilled out. Hmm. And that presents yet another what we call glitch in the system. There's about a half dozen glitches in the system, ranging from banks to interstate commerce to the FDA, et cetera. But there are a lack of product standards as well, which is another reason why the FDA needs to help us, help develop a product standard so that, say, there is a bad actor out there, we're able to address it and make sure that when a consumer goes and buys a bottle, say CBD, they have the confidence to know that what's advertised on the bottle is actually in the bottle.
That clarity, that's what we need. And hemp, the plant itself, is so versatile. You can do a lot of things with hemp. Do you see any meaningful diversification away from just CBD in the future?
Absolutely. And in many ways, we already have it here in Kentucky. Despite being dominated by CBD, we have some growers that are focusing just on seed production. It's also an oil seed. It's kind of like soybean where you can crush it and there's oil. We have a processor right now that's selling hemp curds and seeds actually in Kroger right now. You can go buy it legally and just put them on your salad. Some people think it's a superfood, high protein. And then on the fiber side, we're having relevant discussions right now with the automotive industry in Kentucky. We're the third biggest producer of automobiles. Why not put Kentucky-grown industrial hemp, help make your car a little bit lighter, increase the fuel efficiency, and appeal towards the green market? We even have producers looking at selling this as bedding for animals. We have a guy that's looking at making hardwood out of hemp out in western Kentucky. And as recently as this past week, we had someone wanting to make mattresses out of hemp too. So there's a lot of products that we haven't even seen yet that I think will be derived from Kentucky hemp.
So Commissioner Quarles, a second annual local food systems summit was held recently at the University of Kentucky. And we heard from the organizers that the movement to encourage restaurants and institutions even to use locally sourced farm products is getting stronger by the day. Looking at it from your statewide perspective, why is local sourcing important?
There is a movement out there that's driven by the consumers who are more conscientious than ever about where their food comes from. And this is where Kentucky Proud plays such a pivotal role to help connect consumers who want to buy local with producers in the area. And so this local food summit was yet another example of how we can highlight what can be grown right here in the Commonwealth that can be sold either in cafeterias on campus or in restaurants around Kentucky. Consumers want it. Oftentimes, they're willing to pay an extra dime or cent for locally grown food. And if you ever want to see the vibrancy of Kentucky Proud, just go down to your local farmer's market during a summer day on a Saturday morning and see local agriculture at work. There's millions of dollars which are being driven right now back to our farm community because Kentucky consumers want to buy local.
Ryan Quarles is Kentucky's Commissioner of Agriculture. We thank you for stopping by Eastern Standard.
Glad to be here.
We're beginning a new series on this edition of Eastern Standard. Hosted by Eastern Kentucky University psychologists Melinda Moore and Teresa Botts, the focus is on mental health issues among the people of Eastern Kentucky. Dr. Moore has this first installment. It's about technology to deliver mental health counseling to isolated rural places. Dr. Michael McClelland is her first guest. He's a member of the core clinical faculty of a new doctoral program in clinical psychology here at EKU. His expertise is in rural mental health, cultural competency, and the subject of today's segment, telepsychology. Earlier this year, he opened the EKU Telehealth Clinic.
Welcome, Dr. McClelland.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Several years ago, The Atlantic magazine published an article by psychologist Dr. Jean Twenge about the relationship between the use of technology, such as the iPhone, and the uptick in poor mental health outcomes, such as depression, loneliness, anxiety, and suicide. She emphasized the use of technology among adolescents, but this article really got many Americans of all ages talking about the effects of technology. People seem to react strongly. Others argued that computers, tablets, and iPhones really help bridge the divide between people and address serious disparities, particularly in healthcare created by geography and lack of resources. Dr. McClellan, you created a telehealth clinic in the Department of Psychology at Eastern Kentucky University. Can you tell us about your telehealth clinic and why it was created?
So I started the EKU, the telepsychology clinic, primarily because I wanted to be able to offer some unique training opportunities to our students, and also because our program specializes on training students who we hope are going to graduate with the skills to go out and work with rural and underserved populations. And so I see this telepsychology clinic as a real opportunity to be able to give our students some really unique skills to be able to reach out into the rural areas of Kentucky or really wherever it is that they go.
What are some of these disparities that the telehealth clinic is addressing?
Yeah, for example, in Kentucky, I think roughly about 95% of Kentucky is classified as rural, and most of the areas of Kentucky are considered mental health provider shortage areas. And so telehealth gives us an opportunity to be able to reach out into those areas that just don't have very many clinicians or very many opportunities for people to get mental health related services.
What kinds of services are being provided, and why can't they be provided in person?
Oh, they absolutely could be provided in person. The challenge is, again, because those are mental health shortage areas, it's just really difficult to get enough clinicians into those areas to be able to meet the needs. And so the kinds of services offered through that clinic range anywhere from suicide prevention work, working with people that are struggling with depression. We're able to provide trauma-focused treatment. Really, anything that you could get in a traditional face-to-face experience, we're able to provide through telehealth.
I know you're doing research in this area, and I'm kind of curious to know, what does research in general tell us about how effective these services and treatments are being provided in this way?
First and foremost, just largely looking at the telehealth-related research, what we find is it's a very effective way to provide mental health services. One of the things that I've been doing over the last 2 years is completing various meta-analysis projects with some other folks at EKU. And one of the things that we've been looking at are underserved populations, including people that live in rural areas, people of color, veterans, other specific populations, to also look and see whether or not telehealth can be effective or is effective with those populations. And the one thing that I've been consistently finding throughout that research is it's an effective way to provide services.
You know, it seems like the risks are so great in treating some of these individuals at a distance, such as I'm thinking the suicidal people or people who might be trauma survivors. Shouldn't these people really be hospitalized?
You know, can somebody ever need to be hospitalized? Absolutely. But one of the things that we're able to do through telehealth is we're able to, in some cases, prevent people from needing to go into the hospital. If you think about somebody that's isolated in a rural part of the state, they don't have access to mental health clinicians. One of the things that we can do is to be able to reach out there. And so some of those people who might not necessarily need to go to the hospital, my hope is that we're able to prevent some of those individuals from having to go in to get more inpatient type services, and we can treat those services outpatient.
What are you finding in terms of the services being provided, in terms of individuals responding to these, like the trauma-focused treatment or the suicide-focused treatment? Are you finding that they're responding and being helped significantly?
Yeah, in our clinic we are, but looking at the larger body of research out there, people from lots of different walks of life, people with lots of different types of mental health conditions, are generally really satisfied with the treatment that they're getting through telehealth. They're getting better. And I think, you know, those are some pretty important markers.
What do you think are some of the barriers to widespread adoption of these telehealth services? For instance, are clinicians getting reimbursed for these services?
Absolutely. So, you know, in my own research, I just published an article this past January, and one of the things that we looked at were clinicians' attitudes towards telehealth. And, you know, looking at the major barriers that clinicians identified, all of them appear to be things that we could easily handle through additional education. For example, concerns about whether or not reimbursement is possible. A lot of parity laws, including laws in Kentucky, have made their way through the legislature and been signed into law that have provided for parity, so that generally if you can obtain those services in a face-to-face format, they should be able to be provided and reimbursed through telehealth. You know, other concerns that clinicians had are, for example, whether or not they can build a therapeutic alliance with their clients. And in psychology and clinical psychology, looking at treatment outcomes, one of the largest predictors of whether or not somebody gets well or obtains benefit from services is if they have a good relationship with their therapist. And so one of the things that we're finding with telehealth, A, is that people are getting better and they're able to establish that rapport. But even in clients that don't have as strong of a relationship with their clinicians, they still seem to be getting better. And there's not a lot of research out there on why. I think my own hypothesis, something I would like to look into, is I think people appreciate the value and the convenience of being able to log in to a provider, have a quick conversation or a quick session, and be able to finish up and get right back to work or family-related activities. Whereas, you know, if you live in a pretty remote area, you may need to take 3 hours off of work to drive an hour to a one-hour session and then a lot of time to get back. And so I think what's going on there is people just appreciate the value and the convenience of being able to get those services through telehealth.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Are there any downsides to not engaging in face-to-face services? For instance, are there any instances where clinicians absolutely should insist that a client come to see them in person?
So absolutely. One of the things that we do as mental health clinicians is we always evaluate each client and make a determination whether we're competent to provide those services to begin with. And if we're not, we always look to refer people to another provider. With telehealth specifically, we look at a person's ability to interact with technology, what their skills are, where the person's located. And just to give you an example, you know, if somebody doesn't have very strong computer or technology-related skills, you know, one of the questions that would come up is, well, could somebody provide assistance or help to that individual to get them ready? To give you an example, I personally work with someone who has very difficult computer skills, but the arrangement that I have is they have an IT person or a family member, somebody that can help them log in, make sure the equipment's set up, and then sort of step outside of the room. And so I'm still able to provide some kind of services to that person, even though they might not normally be a good fit.
You know, lastly, I'm wondering, do you think telehealth is the answer to the mental health care disparities in the rural and underserved areas of the United States? More specifically, is it the answer to the problem of lack of access in Appalachia?
I think it absolutely could be. I mean, there was a day and an age where broadband internet was not near as accessible as it is today. But even in Kentucky right now, we have the Kentucky Wire Project that's really trying to get out into rural parts of the state. And so even in the past where there were some challenges related to whether or not there was enough internet speed or bandwidth to be able to provide those services, in this day and age, we're finding that to be much, much less of a barrier.
Dr. McClellan, thank you so much for joining with me today.
Absolute pleasure to be here.
Dr. Michael McClellan of the EKU Department of Psychology with our Mental Health Series host, Dr. Melinda Moore. Coming up after the break,
Kentucky is a welcoming place.
Voices of African immigrants in Kentucky. And
Kentucky is often perceived as a place where queer people cannot exist in peace. They have to get out. But that's not the case.
A forthcoming book about Kentucky's LGBTQ history. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
In this time when a U.S. administration has made restrictions on immigration a top priority, it's interesting to remember that 183 languages are now spoken in the schools of Fayette County. The population of Kentucky is very diverse, probably more so than many of us realize. So when a book landed in my inbox and I spotted the title, I had to reach out to the authors and invite them to a conversation here on Eastern Standard. Two of the four authors of Voice of African Immigrants in Kentucky, Migration, Identity, and Transnationality are here. And Jean Wilson is a professor emerita of education at the University of Kentucky. Ida Otieno was born and grew up in Kenya. She is now a professor of English and African Studies at Bluegrass Community and Technical College, and also directs the Kenya Exchange Program here in Kentucky. We welcome you both to Eastern Standard.
Thank you.
Ida, you are from Kenya, correct?
That is correct.
And yes. When did you arrive in Kentucky?
I arrived in 1996 to Eastern Kentucky University, where I came to pursue my master's degree in English. And then later on, I moved on to the Bluegrass Community and Technical College, where I've worked for 18 years, and I also enrolled at the University of Kentucky College of Education to pursue my doctorate.
And I have to ask, of all the places on planet Earth, how did you wind up in Eastern Kentucky?
Kentucky is a welcoming place, and a lot of African immigrants, at least particularly with my case, I came to pursue further education, higher education. So a lot of immigrant stories also start with that, you know, this desire to come and acquire higher education. So as I mentioned, I came for my master's, then the doctorate. And of course, later on, I started a family here. So it's a wonderful state to raise a family. My husband and I live in Richmond, Kentucky, and we've been living there since. And Kentucky seems to be a welcoming place, you know, for, you know, those who want to go to school, but also start a family away from home.
So good to hear. How many African-born immigrants would you say now live here in Kentucky?
Well, as early as 1990, there were only 1,000 African immigrants in the state of Kentucky. Now we have over 22,000 living in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. So that is quite a jump, most of whom actually are Congolese refugees. And if you may know already, Lexington is a top, you know, city for Congolese refugees. And I must say that the Commonwealth of Kentucky has done a wonderful job creating a home and away from home for some refugees who have had to flee their countries. They did not come by choice, like some of us who came to further our educations. These are involuntary immigrants who happened to make Kentucky home.
You know, I've heard that about Congolese community in Lexington, and I've wondered, how does that work? Is it a matter of a family or two or three arriving here and then sending back the word that, hey, this is a good place. You can
That's
come
correct.
Here.
It's a word of mouth, yes.
But refugees don't have a choice. They come where the agencies want to send them. Not only have a lot of Congolese come here, and we are the fourth largest receiving city in the country, but also secondary migration. So people have friends or relatives, and then more people come. But it is important to recognize that, and we have in this book, we interviewed people who had come from 28 different countries. So although there are many refugees from Democratic Republic of Congo, there are two Congos, also Republic of Congo, there are people from lots of different countries.
There's a word in the title of your book that I wanted to focus on for just a minute, transnationality. Can you define that for us?
Transnationality is a word that Francis Muzzoni brought us, and a concept. And our fourth chapter is entitled connecting and contributing to two continents. And what we mean by that is that Africa-born immigrants relate to both continents. And Ida can give you examples, but that people send home remittances, for example. A country like Liberia several years ago, a quarter of their budget, of their GDP, GNP, was remittances from people in this country. And Ida can tell you how, you know, you may be here, but you're helping people back home.
Tell us about that, Ida.
Well, the question of transnationality is very relevant in our book, because you find that even though we live in the state of Kentucky, in the country, of course, in the United States of America, we have our feet, you know, planted deeply in both places. I mean, if I give the example of myself, so the first half of my life was in my country, Kenya. The second half of my life has been here. So even though I came to go to school and start a family here, there are so many things that I still do back home in terms of supporting, you know, students or kids through college, supporting, you know, relatives. A lot of immigrants do that. There's an example we give in our book, for example, Nigeria, Nigerian immigrants, for example. In 2017, they were sending back home to the tune of $22 billion in remittances, you know, back to the economy. And they're not the only ones that are doing that. A lot of immigrants, whether forced or voluntary immigration, we are living lives in all aspects, in both places.
You know,
it's a beautiful thing, I think.
I would think that being transnational would give you a kind of a unique perspective, a broadened perspective on life itself, really.
Exactly. And as an educator myself, and I've been in higher education for almost 20 years now, I mean, that platform that I bring to the classroom as a transnational individual is an added value to my students in that I bring those multiple perspectives in the way I teach, the books I choose, the themes that we discuss in class. But it's not only in the classroom, even in my communities, you know, the communities we live in, we make the places that act as our host homes better places just because of the perspectives that we bring from other cultures of the world.
Can I give you a quote from a 1916 essay in The Atlantic?
Absolutely.
Because I think that this says this isn't a new idea. This is Randolph Bourne. America is coming to be not a nationality, but a transnationality, a weaving back and forth with many other lands of many threads of all sizes and colors. That's more than 100 years ago he wrote that.
Very apropos today.
Yes.
Are there some general things about Kentucky and its people that those you have interviewed commonly cite, something about living here that is an enjoyment, a pleasure?
Well, speaking for myself and, of course, also from the people we interviewed and just general conversation that I have with my colleagues and friends, Kentucky is a friendly place. It has a southern feel to it, of course, and there are people who go out of their way to help. Of course, I'm not saying that there have not been challenges faced by African immigrants in Kentucky.
And what kind of challenges have...
And we'll talk about that, but in terms of being a friendly host state, there are so many people, even within the city of Lexington and surrounding cities, who have, you know, set up ways of helping immigrants, you know, transition into this life. I mean, if we give you the example of Kentucky Refugee Ministries, for example,
right. They
do a wonderful job relocating people here, ensuring that they are comfortable. And these are volunteers, whether they are churches or organizations that just, you know, contribute money and time and resources to relocate people. We have, for example, the Maxwell Legal Clinic downtown Lexington. They've helped a lot of people, you know, with legal issues sometimes, and they offer free services and also maybe affordable rates for people. So when you have in a small city like our city here in Lexington, organizations and people go out of their way to help like that, you cannot help but fall in love with our state. And I think, and even our mayor is very supportive of immigrant populations. And for that, we are very grateful. So yes, the Commonwealth of Kentucky, I think, has set a trend with regards to being a friendly state for African immigrants. And now we are talking of challenges, right?
Yes, I was going to say, I mean, that's so wonderful to hear. Of course, there are going to be challenges. What have you encountered?
There are challenges. You know, of course, with all success stories, there must be challenges. You know, most of the African immigrants who call Kentucky home, you know, started lives elsewhere. Some of them already had, you know, education and great jobs. Particularly with regards to people from Francophone Africa, French-speaking countries of Africa, they come with a language deficit, you know, mm-hmm. so that most of them, of course, speak French, you know, other languages, and have to start from scratch with regards to learning the language and then going back to school. Sometimes their transcripts or their credentials are questioned, and they end up with some jobs that they would not even touch back home. So that also can bring shame and lack of confidence in some of them. For the children, though, it becomes even harder. The children that are being raised in families, you know, families that are trying to just start over, some of those kids have to grow up very quickly. For example, they become the leaders in the family with regards to interpretation, for example, for their parents. If they are going to the doctor or they're going to other meetings, the kids have to be the ones, you know, translating for them.
They have to be pretty good at picking up on nuance and things like that.
Yes,
they?
Yes. So challenges can be, and there are cases also of blatant racism sometimes. If the kid with a funny name, you know, mm-hmm. the kid whose parents don't have much. You know, and some of those kids, you know, are still very young, formative years. And some of those comments can actually be degrading to them. And of course, even the national dialogue on race, you know, we've had cases where Africa has, for example, been referred to in not very favorable terms. But you see, some of these African kids born of African immigrant parents are in the classroom, they are on social media, they see those things, and sometimes, you know, it gets to them. But overall, you know, with all those challenges, and there also have been successes, particularly with the kids I talk to. These are high-achieving, you know, academic and career-wise kids who are going beyond all odds to start anew. Some of them are starting with their parents, going back to school, and they get jobs, you know, and they contribute to our economy in significant ways.
Ida, I know you have a poem you're going to share with
yes.
us. I want to first ask Angene, before we get to that, if there's anything you'd like to add that you've heard here that you would like to comment on?
Well, I think of a response that one of our interviewees made to the problem really of accent, because there's a lot of I just heard somebody yesterday say something about someone who had an accent that they couldn't understand. And of course, we all have accents. But this person said brains do not have accents.
I think mine did.
Well, I think what that person meant was that sometimes people put down people who have a different accent, mm-hmm. and think that they're not as smart. And when you
ask any Eastern Kentuckian about that, problem.
yes, no, that's true. And a funny story: Francis Muzzoni was coming back from a conference in St. Louis, and somebody said, "Where are you going back to?" And he said, "Well, I'm going back to Kentucky." And the person said, "Oh, I knew you had a Kentucky accent." mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, the writer Silas House has commented that from time to time he feels like a foreigner in his own country when he goes to, you know, the East Coast or the West Coast.
Yes, right.
So interesting. So before we run out of time, I do want to hear that poem, Ida.
Wonderful. And of course, the poem, I wrote it just reflecting on this transnational life of African immigrants and how they're acting in this transnational space, you know, that moving back and forth has given them. The title of the poem is Borderland. They traverse the borderland, voluntary and involuntary sojourners in search of a new beginning in the land of milk and honey. They write letters home, nostalgic memoirs of childhood years, now a distant memory tucked away in the hurl and twirl of the borderland. They work the graveyard shift, send money and honey home, with hopes of a grand return to the place they once knew. They get their degrees in the trenches of the borderland, shuffling and hustling in the daily routine that is norm in the land of opportunity. They meet and marry, raise children and grandchildren with stories of home that was once upon a time. They toss and turn in the dark of night, stroking their snow-white hair as it dawns on them they have been home all along in the borderland.
That was beautiful. Dr. Ida Otieno, Dr. Angene Wilson, co-authors of Voices of African Immigrants in Kentucky, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Them go show, them go show. Them go show themselves clear, clear. Them go show anywhere them day. Anywhere they go.
Them go show,
them go show themselves.
Them go show.
Opposite people.
Them go show.
Anywhere them day.
Them go show.
Everywhere them day.
Them go show.
Them they show themselves.
Them go show.
Opposite people.
Them go show.
Everyone they dance. They dance for enjoyment.
They dance.
Everyone they talk. They talk.
Lexington historian Jonathan Coleman is here with us. Jonathan has a book in the works titled Anywhere Together, A Queer History of Kentucky. And it will be published in early 2021 by the University Press of Kentucky. And as it's in progress, John joins us here on Eastern Standard to tell us about it. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Tom.
So if you would first tell us about the origins of this book.
Sure. So the book itself came out of an archive that I started a few years ago with a Kentucky artist named Robert Morgan. And in 2014, we had just come off a really great year for the LGBTQ history of Kentucky. A documentary had come out. Bob had just done an amazing show at Transylvania University chronicling this history. And it was a moment of what now? So we started to get together. And we basically had a camera rolling. Bob started talking. He started explaining pieces, and then we took those pieces, we placed them in archival housing, made collections guides, and 5 years later, we have an archive of 15,000 objects, over 200 hours of oral histories called the Faulkner Morgan Archive. And as we went out and collected these stories and these artifacts from members of Kentucky's LGBTQ community, I realized as an academic historian, here is an amazingly rich, deeply contextual story that no one has ever really heard before, that is in conversation with national events in LGBTQ history. But then there are some instances that are very much confined to Kentucky itself. And so what role is Kentucky playing in this broader story of what it means to be an LGBTQ American?
Writing about your book in the Lexington Herald Leader, reporter Kevin Nance noted that, quote, gays, lesbians, and others of nonconforming sexuality have a rich and largely untold story that challenges the conventional view of the Bluegrass State as a homophobic wasteland that LGBTQ people have fled the first chance they got. Is that an accurate description?
I think that's an accurate description of the popular narrative.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's actually how things occurred, though, in several ways. One, let's look to New York in the 1960s, which is sort of considered the birth of the modern LGBTQ movement, Stonewall riots, all that good stuff. The first open civil protest of LGBTQ discrimination was in New York, organized by a man named Dick Leisch, who was born and raised in Louisville, Kentucky, didn't move to New York until he was 30, or the first person to ever write about the Stonewall riots. His name was Lige Clark. He was from Hindman, Kentucky. So even in these stories of people leaving, right, those are Kentucky stories too. But here within the Commonwealth, there were LGBTQ Kentuckians who were organizing, who were activists, who were contributing to a greater sense of artistic and personal freedom, an amazing story that needs to be told. Kentucky is often, I believe, in a national imagination, perceived as a place where queer people cannot exist, or they cannot exist in peace. They have to get out. But that's not the case.
So do you think that there's a greater receptiveness now than there might have been 10, 15 years ago?
To this book?
Yes.
I think so. I think so in many ways. One, I think there's a greater receptiveness in terms of academics who study this kind of history, and understanding that if we focus on cities like New York, Paris, London, San Francisco, that we're actually missing out on a great deal of queer history. We're not capturing it all. So there's that kind of acceptance. And then I think there's a broader acceptance in terms of just how people acknowledge that this kind of history matters. You know, it doesn't matter if you're LGBTQ, right? This is a story about people fighting for their rights, people fighting for the acknowledgement of their own humanity. And that is something that affects everyone. It's an idea that all people can identify with.
Do you think that readers of this book, which is yet to be published, but you're well on your way with it, will come away with it with an understanding that LGBTQ people in Kentucky have been far more a part of the fabric than perhaps they realized?
Right. They've always been there. In fact, the earliest story that we have in Kentucky goes all the way back to European settlement. A couple named Robert Craddock and Peter Tardivu. Robert was from Virginia. Peter was from France. They both fought in the American Revolution and ended up with large land grants in what's close to Bowling Green, Kentucky. And the founder of Western Kentucky University, writing in the 1920s, refers to this couple as queer. And they are still buried together right there in the center of Bowling Green.
Who are some of the figures that are prominently mentioned in your book that people might relate to or might understand?
Sure. The book itself is composed of 13 chapters, and each chapter is based on a specific person, an event, a space. And from those individual stories, we break out into broader stories. So there are some really famous individuals in Kentucky's LGBTQ history. Sweet Evening Breeze, who was a black cross-dressing, might today identify as a transgendered person. The Kentucky artist Henry Faulkner, a UK student whose name was Jill Raymond and who spent 14 months in a Kentucky prison for refusing to cooperate with an FBI investigation into lesbian organizing. The preface is named after Kim Davis, the famous Kentucky clerk a few years ago who refused to perform marriages in opposition to same-sex marriage. So a number of folks that people may already recognize, but also individuals they've probably never heard of. One chapter, for example, is named after a music teacher from Shackleton's Music Store, which was on Main Street in Lexington, and his name was Vernon Ishmael. Vernon Ishmael was part of a police entrapment, was caught soliciting a man, and goes home and commits suicide the next day here in Lexington in 1961.
We also had a two-term mayor, Jim Gray, who was openly gay. And we have a sitting judge, Ernesto Scorsone.
Exactly, and, yeah.
Keeping that in mind, do you see positive signs of greater acceptance, perhaps more so in some places than others?
You can't deny that there's greater acceptance. Simply going back to Ernesto, for example, Judge Scorsone, in a case that he helped in the 1980s, 1990s, the Jeffrey Wasson case, which eventually decriminalized sex between partners of the same sex. So just the fact that it's not criminal anymore, you know, all the way back to the early 1990s shows, yeah, there's been a movement forward. There's greater acceptance. Of course, the marriage decision in 2015 is something that is that is laudable. But at the same time, we have to be aware that this acceptance is not universal and is not complete. There is still fighting to do. And there are areas, typically it seems to be larger urban areas, where there are senses of community and acceptance. But at the same time, we can't deny the way that LGBTQ folks are making community and forming bonds and fighting for acceptance in their own hometowns, in their own hollers, right, in their own farms here in Kentucky. And you see this happening in some really cool ways right now. Very popular Instagram account, one of the most popular on Instagram, actually, is called Queer Appalachia. And it connects LGBTQ Appalachians together through, you know, a social media platform. So things are changing, and they are generally changing for the better.
So, John, what do you hope to achieve by publishing this book? It's coming out next year in 2021. Looking forward, what do you hope is on the other side of it?
I want this book to do a lot. So I'm a trained academic historian, dry, dusty, you know, you're not supposed to get involved. But of course, for a book like this that's so close to home, it's very difficult not to. So there are a few things I want this book to achieve. First, I want it to speak to other historians. I want them to be able to look at this book and realize, yeah, there is a history here of sexuality, a history here of activism, a history here of gender that is unique and different. It's a history that has something to contribute to the larger story. And that's important to me as a historian. As a Kentuckian and as someone who identifies as queer, I want people to be able to take up this book and realize they are part of a grand narrative, an amazing story of other people who were like them, who refused to sit down, who carved out a space for themselves. And they held that space. That's a powerful legacy to have.
Lexington historian John Coleman on his forthcoming book, Anywhere Together, A Queer History of Kentucky. It's coming out in 2021. The University Press of Kentucky will be doing the publishing. Thank you, John.
Thank you, Tom.
Well, that wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEK mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.